than 100 people have been killed since the beginning of the ceasefire more than 10 weeks ago. Since the beginning of the ceasefire, these violations have been non-stop, attacking the people's homes and attacking the people's returning to their homes and to their areas in the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation is claiming that these people or these population are trying to go back to areas that are penetrating the yellow line, the so-called yellow line. However, this yellow line includes more than 53% of the total areas withdrawn from, and that is a huge, huge spaces for the Palestinians. We are talking about half of the people or half of the population are now unable to return back to their homes and to their areas in the eastern parts of Gaza City. Again, this is a bold violation of the ceasefire agreement, and that this is another violation. The other is attacking fatally the people who are trying to go back to these areas. Again, the Israeli occupation army is clinging to protect, you know, in order like to kill or to mass shoot towards the Palestinian people. This is happening in a very important context. The Israeli occupation army wants the people in Gaza to feel the presence of the Israeli troops. They want them to feel and to fear the presence of the Israeli troops in these areas. In particular, they don't want the Palestinian population to feel the calmness or to breathe the calmness of a ceasefire taking place. So again, the situation remains really very tense, and people are very cautious nowadays. They are anticipating what the coming days will bring very cautiously, because the Israeli occupation army does not abide to the ceasefire agreement. And another bold violation of the ceasefire agreement is not allowing the unrestricted flow of aid into the Gaza Strip.
I'm going to have to cut you off there, as always, as you did. It clearly show the continued suffering of the Palestinians, not only from the violations of the Zionist entity, but the continued lack and dire humanitarian situation. Ghada Brahim, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah, thank you very much. The Hamas resistance movement says a delegation led by its Gaza leader, Khalil al-Hayya, is in the Egyptian capital of Cairo to follow up on the implementation of the ceasefire agreement. The movement said in its statement that the delegation will discuss the implementation of the truce deal with the mediators, as well as other Palestinian factions and groups. It added that the delegation will also explore ways to reinforce the truce and halt repeated Israeli violations. The new development came after Hamas reaffirmed in an earlier statement its full commitment to the ceasefire agreement, placing full responsibility for any escalation or collapse of the deal on the Israeli regime. The movement said it has abided by the agreement in both letter and spirit and has taken no stop to breach or obstruct the deal. Hamas also called for urgent international intervention to ensure the implementation of the truce and stop Israel's violations. While students at the University of Houston have staged a hunger strike in a show of solidarity with Palestinians suffering under a years-long Israeli siege in the Gaza Strip. We have a report.
UH divest from debt.
UH divest from debt.
UH divest from debt.
UH divest from debt.
Today, students at the University of Houston have entered the third day of a hunger strike in solidarity with Gaza. Their protest is part of a growing wave of student-led actions across U.S. campuses, calling attention to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and demanding institutional accountability. The hunger strike targets the university's financial and research ties to weapons manufacturers and technology firms involved in global arms production. Students argue that these companies play a direct role in enabling Israel's military campaign in Gaza, which has drawn international condemnation for widespread civilian casualties and destruction of infrastructure. Participants have issued a list of demands to the university administration. These include divesting from weapons companies, canceling all military research contracts, removing brands linked to apartheid from campus, and declaring the university a sanctuary campus. These demands reflect a broader call for ethical investment and institutional transparency. In recent days, more students have joined the strike, signaling growing concern over the university's partnerships and funding sources. Organizers say the action is not only about Gaza, but also about challenging the role of academic institutions in perpetuating violence through financial and research collaborations.
Today is day 3 of the Samud hunger strike. I am announcing my entry into the strike because the university has made it apparent that they will not answer our demands without escalation.
The protest comes amid a global outcry over the humanitarian conditions in Gaza, where famine and displacement have intensified following months of blockade and bombardment by the Israeli regime. Students across the U.S., Canada, and Europe have launched similar hunger strikes, encampments, and sit-ins, demanding that universities sever ties with companies complicit in the genocide. Activists argue that universities must take moral responsibility for their connections to the military-industrial complex. They emphasize that academic institutions should not profit from war or occupation, and must instead stand for human rights, peace, and justice.
Well, hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters have rallied through the Spanish capital, Madrid, in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Gaza. Protesters chanted slogans demanding an end to the Israeli regime's ceasefire violations. The demonstrators slammed Israel for preventing the entry of humanitarian supplies into the besieged territory. They also denounced the United States for aiding Israel in its genocide in Gaza, calling for justice for the Palestinians killed during the Israeli onslaught. Describing Israel as the worst apartheid, the protesters called for a just and lasting peace in Gaza. On Sunday, Palestinian officials announced that Israel has committed 80 violations since the truce started, resulting in 97 deaths and 230 injuries. A viral video from the occupied West Bank is making global headlines. Captured by an American journalist, the footage shows masked Israeli settlers ambushing Palestinian farmers during the olive harvest, an attack that has reignited calls for accountability and protection. We have details in this report.
Tensions continue to escalate in the occupied West Bank as Israeli forces and settlers intensify their actions against Palestinian communities. A shocking new video has surfaced, capturing a brutal ambush by Israeli settlers on Palestinian farmers. On October 19th, as Palestinian farmers began their olive harvest in Termas Aya, chaos erupted. A Brooklyn-based journalist, Jasper Nathaniel, was on the scene, capturing spine-chilling footage of masked Israeli settlers attacking Palestinian farmers with crude melee weapons. In a post shared on social media, Nathaniel described the harrowing experience.
On the first day of the olive harvest, the Israeli force leads a group of farmers directly into a brutal ambush by armed settlers. These people need to be in prison by tomorrow, and the people of this village, and all across Palestine, need to be protected. Enough is enough.
Following the attack, Nathaniel reported his ordeal to the U.S. Embassy, only to be told they could not provide protection. He then wrote on the social media X that, "The U.S. Embassy said that no, they cannot protect me." The incident has sparked a wave of reactions online. One user pointed out the glaring double standards in international responses, stating that if an American tourist were attacked in any other country, it would lead to a major diplomatic crisis. As Nathaniel's clip went viral, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, shared Nathaniel's video, emphasizing that such violent incidents have persisted for years without accountability. This latest episode of settler violence comes amid a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. As tensions rise and violence escalates in the West Bank, the international community is left grappling with how to respond to these alarming developments.
Well, another Palestinian abductee has died in Israeli jails after the regime denied him medical treatment despite his deteriorating health. According to Palestinian sources, 49-year-old Mahmoud Talal Abdullah was abducted from the Jenin refugee camp by Israeli forces in early February. Abdullah's health condition deteriorated sharply after his abduction, and he was later diagnosed with advanced cancer. Despite his condition, the Israeli regime refused to release him, transferring him from one prison to another and keeping him in detention until his death. Abdullah had previously been detained during the Al-Aqsa Intifada in 2002. His death brings the number of Palestinian abductees who have died in Israeli prisons since the start of the regime's Gaza genocide to 79. Well, Yemenis have gathered in the streets of Sana'a to hold a funeral procession for Major General Mohammed al-Ghamadi, the chief of the staff of the Yemeni armed forces who was martyred in an Israeli strike. Now we're joined by our correspondent, Abdel Latif Al-Mashari, for more. Abdel Latif, let's remind that the general was not assassinated by himself. He had several comrades with him, and of course also his son, his young son, was with us. What has and how important is Major General Mohammed Al-Ghamari, specifically over the last few years with the solidarity with Palestine?
Thank you so much. Thousands of people poured into Jami' al-Shaab today in the capital of Sana'a to bid farewell to Major General Mohammed Abdel Karim Al-Ghamari with his son and two companions who were with him while the Israeli strike hit the building they were in. General Mohammed Abdel Karim Al-Ghamari was one of the country's most prominent military leaders. He was known for his achievements in the missile program. He was also known for leading the Red Sea operations against the Israeli vessels and also leading the missile forces to hit the Israeli territories. He was one of the most prominent leaders. He was very important for the Yemeni army, for the Yemeni people. Today, the atmosphere was charged with grief and also with the pride and sincere feelings. They loved this leader. They knew that he was leading the Yemeni army during the past 2 years and even before. But you know, the past 2 years since the beginning of Al-Aqsa flood, it was a very sensitive phase of the confrontation with the Israeli enemy. So the people were there today. Thank you to General Mohammed Al-Ghamari for the achieving milestones in developing, you know, cluster munitions and also hypersonic missiles that hit Israeli cities several times. The people today thank General Mohammed Al-Ghamari, and they are very trusting the new leader, the chief of staff in the Yemeni army. The new leader is Yusuf Al-Madani. We hope that he will do as well as Sayyid Mohammed Al-Ghamari.
Yemeni people have proved more than once that they are definitely steadfast in the support of the Palestinians until the regime stops its genocide. There, everyone, our correspondent Abdel Latif Al-Washali joining us from Sana'a. Thank you very much. Well, Iran has once again reiterated that the country is entitled to nuclear enrichment and other peaceful nuclear activities after UN Security Council Resolution 2231 expired on Sunday. Iran's foreign ministry called on the secretariat of the council to also consider the resolution terminated. Ismail Baghaei said the UN Security Council never decided on the reinstatement of anti-Iran sanctions under the resolution snapback mechanism before the resolution expired. Baghaei said the UK, France, and Germany abused international mechanisms for their political purposes. This, he said, has faced opposition by the majority of the world countries. China and Russia have issued a joint statement with Iran to underline the expiration of Resolution 2231. The non-aligned movement also recently endorsed Iran's position on the resolution and the termination of the UN sanctions against the country.
Well, thank you very much for Basara's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Bye for now.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, it's now time for a short lecture by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani. In this session, he delves into the teachings of the book for the Hadith by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This book is a profound exploration of ethical and mystical concepts in Islamic spirituality. Let's listen and reflect together.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We will continue, inshallah, with our discussion on the topic of khawf and raja. And then you come across a hadith, and this is where Imam Khomeini really wants to put that hope into your heart and into my heart. He says that hadith tells us that the mercy that we have seen from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this world, what's the mercy you've seen from Him? All the blessings every human being has, that's a manifestation of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He says, all of this mercy that you've seen from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this world, narration says that this mercy is only one dharra, one tiny little dot, compared to the mercy that He shows on the Day of Judgment. I will repeat that because it's not a small line. It says, all the mercy that you saw in this world is one dot compared to the mercy that He shows on the Day of Judgment. What mercy is this? I have no idea. I don't know. You and I can't imagine what this mercy is like. He says, this, everything that He did in this world is just one dot. You haven't even, you know, scratched the surface of His mercy. But you know, this all makes sense. If you understand you're empty-handed, get that part. That's the khawf part. You understand that? Okay, great. Here's the mercy is. This is the package we're offering on the mercy side. On the mercy side, He's saying what you've seen of Me so far is not even a dot compared to what you're going to see from Me. And then the narrations continue. And He tries to explain that this whole world, why is it that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not manifested His mercy so much in this world? Because fundamentally, He doesn't even care about this world. He cares about what happens. What He's trying to say is that this world inherently has very little value in His eyes. It has so little value that God doesn't even want to do His thing in this world. No, this is just a place where you come and get tested and so on and so forth. His mercy, His blessings, His grace, there's another place for that. He doesn't find this world worthy of showing His mercy fully in it, of manifesting His mercy fully in it. That's why He's going to keep that for where? He's going to keep that for the next world. And this is why we read in the lines of the first Imam, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wasalamu alayhi. He's trying to explain how little Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala thinks of this world. And through this, Imam Khomeini is mentioning this so that you understand that whatever mercy He's showing in this world is just a little bit of His mercy. It's a little bit of His mercy because He doesn't care about this world anyways too much. If He cares about it, if He were to care about it, His mercy would have been a whole lot more. He says, this dunya فَمَا لَهَا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ قَدْرٌ وَلَا وَزْنٌ. In His eyes, it has almost no value. So it has no weight, has no importance in His eyes. وَلَا خَلْقٌ فِي مَا بَلَغَنَا خَلْقًا أَبْغَذَ إِلَيْهِ مِنْهَا. If anything, He dislikes this world out of everything else that He has created the most. Like, why? Because this is the place where it's full of limitations, full of, you know, injustices, full of darkness, full of sins, full of disobeying. He dislikes this world the most compared to all the other worlds that He has created that are awaiting you and I. He continues, وَلَا نَذَرَ إِلَيْهَا مُنْذْ خَلَقَهَا. And He has never looked at this world with a full look of mercy since He created it. Hey, the mercy you see from Him in this world, just a little bit He's sprinkling here and there. The true mercy, He doesn't even want to show it here because He doesn't even find it worthy of His mercy. He continues. He says, the way you know, it's very beautiful, very beautiful. He says, the way you know this dunya is not worth anything is the following. He says, وَلَقَدْ عَرَضَتْ عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا بِمَفَاتِيحَهَا وَخَزَائِنَهَا لَا يَنْقُسُهُ ذَلِكَ مِنْ حَذِّهِ مِنَ الْآخِرَةِ فَأَبَى. He says, you know how, if there's one thing you want to take away from today's khutbah, this is the line I want you to take away. He said, you know how I can tell you this dunya is not worth anything? He said, because our Prophet was handed the keys to this dunya. The narration says, Jibreel came to the Prophet and said, Ya Rasulullah, God says, if you want to have this dunya with its keys, meaning like the keys to the treasures of the world, right? You and I, we don't know where the treasures lie. God knows where the treasures lie. He came to the Prophet and he said, if you want to take all of this, and your reward and your status in the akhirah will not be decreased. If it's going to be decreased, of course the Prophet would say no. He's the Prophet. But he says no. Jibreel, in that hadith, Jibreel came and said, you take the keys of this world and nothing will be decreased from your level. Now pay attention. And the Prophet said, Abba. The Prophet said no. Why, Ya Rasulullah? Nothing decreased from the next world. Just take the keys in this world. Sounds very smart. Just take the keys in this world, everything is fine. And the next world, everything is fine as well. He says, because the Prophet wanted to teach us that that which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala considers to have no value, He also wants to confirm that it has no value in His eyes. Because He knows Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looks at this world and says, this world is not worthy of you. He said, I'm not going to take the keys to it either. Because if He says it's not worthy of me, I'm not going to consider it worthy of me either. If He sagharahu, if He's considered it little, if He's belittling this world, I'm going to belittle this world as well. Even if it's not going to decrease from my level in the akhirah. And then He continues, He says, وَلَوْ لَمْ يُخْبِرْكَ عَنْ سِغَرَهَا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ إِلَّا. He says, if you really want to know how little this dunya is, just let this be the one thing that you walk away with. He says, it's so little in the eyes of God that God has not even used this world to reward His good servants. His good servants, He didn't give him from this world. That means it's worth nothing in His eyes. And His bad servants, He gave him from this world. This means what? This means it's like, you know, that, forgive me, that piece of tissue that you use and you just want to throw it away. And you come across this person who's a murderer. Like people we have today in the world, yes? Like politicians you have today in the world. This person's a murderer and God says, you know what? Yeah, he can have this. Is it because he likes this guy? No, he hates this guy. And because he hates him, he says, you can have this. And this is what the dunya is. All of this to say that that true mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's going to show up somewhere else. And on the day of judgment in the next world, this mercy is truly going to show itself. I know I'm going over time. There's one more point I want to make before, inshallah, we end. And I want to end with this hadith of the sixth imam. He said, إِذَا كَانَ, look at this hadith, إِذَا كَانَ يَوْمُ الْقِيَامَةِ, when the day of judgment comes, نَشَرَ اللَّهُ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى رَحْمَتَهُ, He shows His mercy to the extent, حَتَّى يَتْمَعَ إِبْلِيسُ فِي رَحْمَتِهِ, that Iblis now gets some thoughts that maybe I can be forgiven as well. Maybe I can benefit from His mercy as well, because it seems almost as if He's forgiving left and right. He gets these thoughts. Of course, it doesn't apply to him, but he even gets these thoughts. The sixth imam says, there's so much mercy on that day. This is khawf, and this is raja, and the believer needs to have both of these in his heart at the same time.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen. Oh,
A diverse range of programs, youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Behind the scenes of major political changes across different parts of the world, large-scale and lucrative economic plans are often designed by prominent theorists or individuals working in the shadows. These plans operate in a way that aligns colonial superpowers to sacrifice weaker nations and plunder their natural resources. This is part of the speech by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, at the United Nations. It promises a grand and ambitious vision for the construction of a strategic corridor stretching from New Delhi to West Asia, a corridor that passes through the Israeli-occupied territories and reaches Europe. According to Netanyahu, this plan is to transform the lives of over 2 billion people.
This is the map I presented here last year. It's a map of a blessing. It shows Israel and its Arab partners forming the land bridge connecting Asia and Europe between the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. Across this bridge, we will lay rail lines, energy pipelines, fiber optic cables, and this will serve the betterment of 2 billion people.
To implement and exploit this plan, major changes in the geopolitics of West Asia were underway, changes which were initiated by a devastating and destructive war and the displacement of millions in Palestine and Lebanon. Perhaps the answer to the question that many ask about why Israel is unwilling to end this war lies hidden within the secrets of grand economic schemes in cooperation with the world's superpowers. Transforming the lives of 2 billion people in other parts of the world at the cost of death, displacement, and the destruction of the homes of millions in the Middle East. The idea of connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean and ending Egypt's monopoly over maritime passage through the Suez Canal dates back to 1956 and the Suez Crisis. The proposed plan involves a route stretching 260 kilometers, ultimately connecting the Gulf of Aqaba and the port of Eilat to the Mediterranean by crossing the Negev Desert.
Prime Minister Ben-Gurion of Israel arrives at Princeton, New Jersey to call on Dr. Albert Einstein, one of the world's greatest scientists, the father of relativity and the man whose physics formula led the way to the atomic explosion, plays host to the leader who played a great part in the creation of the Israeli nation.
In a document recently declassified by the United States, dated 1963, Howard David Maccabee, an American specialist, proposed the idea of carrying out 520 nuclear explosions for deep excavation in the Negev Desert. This massive project became known as the Ben-Gurion Canal. been rumors about the potential revival of this project. Based on the proposal, an estimated $100 billion would be required for the project's implementation, with an anticipated annual revenue of $10 billion from vessel transit fees.
The Ben-Gurion Canal was a wild proposal made in the 1960s to build a canal through Israel from the port of Eilat on the Red Sea all the way to the Mediterranean, the idea being to create an alternative route to Egypt's Suez Canal, which already connects them.
The general design of the Ben-Gurion Canal, from a technical perspective, is envisioned as a passage with a depth and width of 50 to 200 meters and rocky walls. This design has greater depth compared to the Suez Canal and requires less maintenance and repairs. Unlike the Suez Canal, this canal is planned to operate as a two-way passage for both directions. Incidents such as several cases of ships getting stuck and the blockage of the Suez Canal have once again brought up the issue of constructing and operationalizing the Ben-Gurion Canal. If the Zionist leaders succeed in implementing and operationalizing the Ben-Gurion Canal plan, many Arab and Islamic countries in the region will become directly dependent on this project. The potential commercial benefits of this plan will gradually place these countries in a difficult and limited position in future political discussions and negotiations regarding regional developments. Some political observers have linked Israel's efforts to make the Gaza Strip unlivable and to evacuate it with removing any obstacles or resistance to the implementation and exploitation of this plan.
But what is the Ben-Gurion Canal? Well, it aims to connect the Red Sea with the Mediterranean Sea. The Gaza Strip gets in the way of all of this. If you look at the mapping, the proposed direction of the Ben-Gurion Canal from the Red Sea, from Eilat, it's kind of swerving away from the Gaza Strip. But it would be very convenient if Israel controlled the Gaza Strip and had the Ben-Gurion Canal flow from there.
Moreover, routing the canal through or even near the Gaza Strip would shorten the connection between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, reducing the overall cost of the project. In fact, the initial plan for the canal involved passing it through the port of Ashkelon, located north of Gaza. However, the implementation of a complex security plan involving the complete destruction of existing structures in the Gaza Strip and turning it into an uninhabitable area by Israel, the starting point of the canal has been selected near the northern part of Gaza. Oceanic trade in general and the remarkable economic growth of East and South Asian countries have garnered increased attention in Israeli circles. Considering the cordial relations between Israel and India, which have evolved into deep economic and commercial partnerships since the 1990s, the idea of the India-Middle East-Europe corridor, whose memorandum of understanding was signed during the G20 summit in 2023, has attracted Israel's interest. Such a project could significantly impact China's mega-initiative known as the One Belt, One Road, and its efforts to establish economic influence in West Asia. Strengthening the economy of the Persian Gulf Arab countries bloc and reducing the roles of Turkey and Iran in the regional economy is considered a favorable scenario from Israel's perspective. The potential establishment of the aforementioned corridor also aligns with diminishing the significance of the North-South corridor for these two countries. November of 2020, rumors surfaced in the media about a secret and unannounced meeting between Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and Mike Pompeo, the then U.S. Secretary of State, at the site of Noam Project under construction in northwest Saudi Arabia on the coast of the Red Sea.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refused to discuss details of a landmark meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia that reportedly took place over the weekend.
I think there high likelihood there was a meeting. Certainly, it could be something that happened. The American ambassador Abizad was with the foreign minister, and Pompeo was there. Maybe in another room, MBS, the Crown Prince, met with Bibi with Pompeo. So, you know, I think it's just the dance. But this is all what the going forward is. This is a message.
4 years later, amid the Gaza war, during a Likud party gathering, a proposal was raised for establishing a Gaza al-Arish Deir al-Balah free trade zone, which strengthened speculations about linking this route to the Ne'om project and creating a commercial hub at the intersection of the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. Considering the proposal of the Ben-Gurion Canal, the idea of connecting these two projects and placing the Gaza Strip at their junction can also be envisioned. This could serve as an incentive for Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to invest in the reconstruction and administration of Gaza in the manner desired by Israel once the conflict subsides. On the other hand, extending this plan to Al-Arish port in Egypt and the Sinai Desert could partially alleviate Egypt's concerns about the diminishing role of the Suez Canal in global trade. Given the relative insecurity in the Sinai Desert and Gaza, which has impacted Egypt's national security, this project could create an additional attraction for Egypt's allies.
It's their 2035 Gaza plan to rebuild Gaza into an Israeli version of Dubai. Well, look no further than the brand new Gaza 2035 plan, which Netanyahu unveiled this weekend. Great timing, too. He's like, hey, we're about to destroy Rafah, totally eliminate about a million people. Here's a 9-page PDF for our plan. This is what we plan to do in Gaza, which is perfect. It's like a, you know, we want to build our own Dubai in Gaza. Perfect timing. So take a look at this. This is the new Israel 2035 plan for Gaza. Look how beautiful that will look once they rebuild it and kick all of those all those dirty Palestinians out of there. Mm-hmm. And they'll build new rail infrastructure, new port infrastructure, be easy access to all of that oil. And they'll be able to get all of this into the Middle East economy. So a place so devoid of Palestinians, of course, as they describe it. They describe it as a future where Gaza is de-radicalized from Islamism, transformed into a trade hub of prosperity and innovation, and integrated into the Middle East economy. So a place totally devoid of Palestinians, of course. According to the Jerusalem Post, it's almost like they had this plan for a while, right? I mean, seems like they probably already had this whole thing mapped out a long time ago.
Beyond the issue of building a major corridor for the transportation of goods and energy, Israel is also seeking, in its midterm vision, to achieve secure and local energy resources. Israel's reliance on fossil fuels, reflected in the annual import of billions of dollars worth of oil from countries such as Azerbaijan, Brazil, Kazakhstan, and Nigeria, has led its government to make serious efforts toward attaining new and affordable energy sources.
This is the northernmost point of Israel's coast, its Mediterranean coast, but then a stone's throw away, you have that Hezbollah presence. What a contrast. The story here is the big, huge gas, natural gas reservoir in the eastern basin of the Mediterranean. As you probably know, there has been huge discovery of amount of gas offshore Israel.
Yeah.
One of the sections, called Field Number 9, is a controversial area between Israel and Lebanon, where both sides claim to have larger parts of the specific field.
The vast gas reserves along the east Mediterranean coast, a significant portion of which are located Lebanese waters and near the shores of occupied Palestinian territories, are an attractive option for Israel. In fact, for years now, Tel Aviv has been pursuing efforts to explore and extract gas reservoirs in the waters off the eastern Mediterranean.
Their shared maritime border in the eastern Mediterranean, it's a contested area where Israel has already found hydrocarbons that can be exploited commercially, and where Lebanon is hoping to explore for natural gas.
After the discovery of the Tamar gas field in 2009, the issue of the dispute between Israel and Lebanon regarding the delineation of ownership boundaries and adjacent waters also was raised. The judgment on this matter was entrusted to UN experts to resolve the conflict.
I would like to clarify that the Karish gas field is not disputed, and it has never been. It wasn't even within the line that Lebanon submitted to the UN, which Israel did not agree to. It is not negotiable in any way. It is an Israeli gas field, an Israeli strategic asset. It's a shame. This is not constructive. I suggest that the Lebanese negotiation team proceeds with the talks. After all, it is a civilian economic issue. They should understand that and take better care of their civilians. The state of Israel has been systematically protecting its assets. The Israeli security forces are prepared for any scenario.
Israeli officials have long coveted the Lebanese section of this gas field, which is known as the Kana and Karish fields.
The first look at Israel's new off-sea gas platform. The Karish gas field is being hailed as a revolutionary development for Israel's energy production sector, and plans exist to export its gas to help ease the global energy crisis. But the site has also become a target for cross-border threats from within Israel's northern neighbor.
The efforts to incite war and weaken Hezbollah's defensive capabilities, along with the Lebanese army's strong dependency on Western countries, are also aimed at ensuring the security of the new platforms that are planned to be built in the Karish gas field in the future.
Tamar is already producing natural gas. You can see the pipe going to the rig, and from the rig to the Israeli coast. So here you can see.
Only recently, Israel imported its energy from around the world. For the energy minister, the course is clear. Thanks to gas, the country will not only soon be energy independent, but a net gas exporter.
Currently, with the discovery of the Gaza marine ore and NOAA oil and gas fields and waters near Gaza, the importance of security in this region has increased for Israel.
But there are two gas fields under the Gaza Strip. Gaza Marine 1 and Gaza Marine 2. They were found in 1999. Nearly 25 years ago. In 2000, the Palestinian Authority, that was one of the organizations that participated in this secret meeting in Geneva, they requested British Gas explore what they thought was under the Gaza Strip. And British Gas identified a 30 billion cubic meter of gas reserves under the Gaza Strip.
Initial searches for oil and gas resources in the waters near the Gaza Strip were conducted in the late 1990s by the British company BBG, leading to the discovery of a large Gaza marine gas field located 17 to 21 nautical miles off the Gaza coast. According to the second Oslo Accord signed in 1995, ownership of the Gaza marine gas field was granted to the Palestinian Authority.
The problem is that Israel has not signed any related convention so far, including, and this is the most important, the Convention of the Law of the Sea. Israel is out of the international community's rules.
In 2000, a 25-year contract was signed between the Palestinian Authority and the BBG company, which led to the development of exploration activities. It was estimated the Gaza marine gas field contained over 1.4 trillion cubic feet of extractable natural gas, which could have served as a solid economic foundation for the Palestinian Authority.
This is just one of the many reserves of fossil fuels that are in Israel, in the occupied territory of Palestine, and in international waters. Now, in 2019, the UN released a report on these fuels, stating that they were valued at $524 billion. Now, that's half a trillion in 2019 money. Under no circumstances would a Netanyahu government allow for Palestine to exploit
Israel's illegal occupying actions regarding energy resources and waters near Gaza reflect the long-term ambitions of this regime to access the energy resources of the Mediterranean and Gaza. These actions are carried out with the aim of imposing its policies and objectives on Palestine and Lebanon through the use of force and military power.
But if it's gas and oil, and they have a canal that's making them, could be, tens of billions of dollars profit per year, 50 billion barrels of oil under the Gaza Strip. And the strategy for the Israelis, they said this.
One of the main reasons for the recent war and the forced displacement of Gaza Strip residents to a small area in the southern part of this region is Israel's fixation on Gaza's vast gas reserves. Following complete occupation and removal of any obstacles and resistance in this area, Israel aims to securely seize all the fossil reserves along the Gaza coast for its own benefit.
That love strikes only once. That precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road? You are my guide. Gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease. Someday there'll be justice, someday there will be peace. Possess, I offer you. I wanna be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans of the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on September 20th, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. A Another achievement of the sacred defense was that it expanded our frontiers. I'm not speaking of its geographical borders. We do not seek to expand our geographical borders, neither at that time nor now. We are not seeking to expand our geographical borders. The sacred defense expanded our other frontiers, such as the frontier of resistance. This is an example. Today, the concept of resistance and the element of resistance is an established element. There's resistance in Palestine, there's resistance in West Asia, and there's resistance in various other countries. There's resistance in Iraq. There's resistance in Iran and in various places. The sacred defense raised and promoted the idea of resistance around the world. It established resistance in many parts of the world. We ourselves may find it hard to believe that the actions of the Iranian nation have had such an impact in distant countries, but they have had such an impact. We have information about this. I do not wish to name the countries. A large number of the Iranian nation's activities have served as a model for many people in the East, in Asia, in Africa, and also in Latin America. This is what expanding frontiers means. Intellectual and cognitive borders have expanded. This is a nation's greatest success, to be able to expand its own culture, understanding, knowledge, and wishes in the world. This mainly took place by way of the sacred defense. The 8 years of the sacred defense worked miracles in this aspect. It spread the culture of self-reliance. Now, when we speak about resistance, we want to see whom this resistance is standing against. Our region, West Asia, is one of the regions that the world's power seekers have been focused on for various reasons. The powerful countries of the world have focused on this region and tried to interfere in it because of its resources, because of its geographical location, because of its being the center for Islam, and for multiple other reasons. Even now, we can see that the powerful countries interfere and intervene whenever they have the opportunity. The resistance is standing against these things. The culture of resistance against the domineering presence of powerful countries that have no right to be in this region has now spread widely. This is the reason why the issue of the presence of Iran in this region has angered the U.S. and some other countries.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. welcome to all our listeners from around the world. I'm Asma here in Tehran announcing our program schedule for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us until the early hours of this morning. We start tonight's lineup with today's special daily mix format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Then we have our radio productions feature. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salam, dear friend. Inshallah, you are doing well, and thank you for choosing this program to listen to. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Come with us because we're going to speak about the concept of a word. Nomophobia means the fear of being without your phone. So be with us. Today is Monday, 27th of Rabiul Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 28th of Mehr, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 20th of October, 2025.